For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Yeah, so we're going to get into the life of this guy, Abraham. Abraham is a figure known to history. He's a descendant of Noah's son, Shem. So after the flood, Noah and his family populated the earth. Noah had three sons. One son, Shem, had a line of descendants that Abraham was connected to. Abraham, most people think he was born in 2166 BC. So he was alive over 4,000 years ago in a town called Ur. If you look on a map, that's the Mediterranean in blue on the left, the Persian Gulf on the bottom right. So Ur is modern day Iraq. That was his home country. That's where Abraham is from. His name, Abraham, means father of a multitude, father of many peoples. And that's fitting because many nations trace their lineage back to Abraham. If you follow the story in Genesis, Abraham had a son Isaac, who had a son Jacob, whose descendants became the people of Israel. And many other nations actually trace their roots back to this guy. Same thing with many other faiths. Not just nations, but many religions like Islam, Judaism, and Christianity all look back at this guy as part of their roots, part of their story. The other thing that's kind of striking about him is how much of this book is devoted to his life. From chapter 11 all the way up through chapter 25. And it makes sense because not just in the Bible, but in history, this guy is a titanic figure. Now, obviously, if you look at that stretch, way too much to cover, too much material. But I want to focus all the way through on a theme. Because if you survey Abraham's life, if you look at what the Bible, the rest of the Bible says about Abraham, this theme really kind of encapsulates his life. And it's that God does great things through unlikely people who obey him in faith. Yeah, God does great things through unlikely people who obey him in faith. That's really what his life's all about. Let's just chunk down through this real quick. So by a great thing, you know, I saw Apollo 11 last Sunday. Have you guys seen that yet? It's in the theater, not Apollo 13, Apollo 11. It's a documentary, and it has no modern commentary, and it just shows from start to finish the mission that put Neil Armstrong on the moon. And one thing that's really striking is some of the footage where Kennedy's speaking. And he's just got such a crystal clear, great thing he wants America to accomplish. You know, he's like, we're going to put a man on the moon and return him safely to the earth by the end of this decade. Super clear. And when it happened, it was awe-inspiring. It was a great thing. And the great thing we're looking at in the early chapters of Genesis is something even more powerful. It's something that God's been working on and is continuing to work on. It's really the story of the whole Bible, and we're seeing it begin to unfold here. And we'll get more into specifically what that is. Through unlikely people, in this story, God comes to Abraham. Of all the people he could come to, and recruits Abraham to play a key role in this great thing that he wants to do. And Abraham was a very unlikely candidate. If you think about his family, he's from a family of people who came from Ur, whose god was Ur-Nammu, the moon god. He came from a family of moon worshippers. His dad's name literally meant moon. His wife, Sarai, later Sarah, her name means moon god's wife. His brother, Haran, is named after a city that was devoted to the moon god city. His niece, Milcah, meant moon god daughter. Okay, so if your dad is moon and you got moon god wife, moon god city, moon god daughter, it's likely you're a moon worshiper, right? And yet, this is the guy that God chose to work through. to not just work through, but to carry out a very key role in this great thing he's doing. Now, the last part of this concept is something called obeying in faith. It's a little more complicated. I can't summarize it. I'll explain it as I go through in a little bit. But there it is. That's what we're going to be talking about. And what we're going to do is we're going to pick and choose parts of Abraham's story that illustrate this key theme. You guys with me? So this is what we're going to do. Let's talk about the great thing that God is doing. If you want to appreciate the amazing thing God's trying to do, you have to understand the problem he's trying to address. And in the beginning of Genesis, quite a few things happen that aren't so great. You know, Adam and Eve, they rebel against God. Then Adam and Eve's son, Cain, kills his brother Abel. And that wasn't the first murder. That was the beginning of a trend. We see more murders. We see increasing wickedness. Things get so bad, God wipes things out in a flood. And then even after that flood, we see wickedness and pride burbling up again, like we saw last time I was here in the Tower of Babel. And so as the Bible story goes on early on, the problem is crystal clear. And the problem is that human beings are constitutionally sinful. They're pervasively sinful and persistently sinful. Over and over again, they won't be stopped. It just seems like this is a freight train that nobody can slow down. So this is the problem. The problem is he's either got to move in judgment or he's got to find another way. And he does. Humanity has a problem, so God responds with a solution. And this solution is the great thing that God is doing, the solution to human sin. And there's hints of it from the very first part of this book. We read in Genesis 3:15 that God is going to send a promised son, a descendant of Eve. And this guy is going to conquer Satan. He's going to destroy the work of Satan, it says. And we, you know, it's very shadowy. We don't know who this male descendant is or when he'll come. But we also start to learn that this person is going to offer his life for sin. This is foreshadowed that God's solution to the eruption of sin in the world is to have a human being, a descendant of Eve, a promised son, die for us in our place. And it's symbolized by the growing theme of sacrifice and some very pointed symbolism in chapter 22 that points directly to Jesus Christ. As we continue to go on, along with this hint of a promised son who'll do a great thing, who'll address human sin, along with this, you can tell there's curiosity, there's mounting interest in who is this guy? You know, when Eve had a son, Seth, who replaced Abel, the son that was murdered, she wondered, is this the one? That's what Seth's name means, the appointed one. When Noah was born, his parents wondered, is this the guy that's going to undo the curse? Is he the one? And all the way through, you see this growing interest, and it's not until today. Here, you know, as we're studying, as we've come to this part of this book, it's not until today that we stumble into the passage in which we have God's plan revealed. So this is momentous. We've been kind of building up to Genesis 12. Genesis 12 is where God starts to put down cards in his hand and starts to lay out the details of his plan to rescue humanity from the problem of sin. So let's go ahead and read it. It says, "The Lord said to Abraham, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house." And then real quick, I should throw in here. Well, I will in a second. I'll keep reading. "Go forth from your country, from your relatives, from your father's house, to the land that I'll show you. And I'll make you a great nation, and I'll bless you and make your name great. And so you shall be a blessing. And I'll bless those who bless you. And the one who curses you, I will curse. And in you, Abraham, through one of your descendants, all of the families of the earth will be blessed. Okay, so there it is. Now, I realize there's a lot in there. Just a couple things to orient you. First of all, it says Abram. I keep saying Abraham. That's because Abram is later renamed Abraham. So I'm just going to say Abraham all the way through, just to cut down on confusion. The other thing to know about this is now he's in Haran. He's left Ur over by the Persian Gulf. He's traveled with his family. As he hears God lay out this promise, he's up in this new town of Haran. And instead of getting into every single detail, here's kind of the highlights, the main part of this that you need to know. God tells Abraham, I'm going to grow your descendants into a great nation. And that great nation becomes the people of Israel. He tells Abraham, I'm going to give you a land. And that land, as the Bible unfolds, is south and west of Haran, kind of along the Mediterranean Sea, along the Jordan Valley. It's the promised land. He also says this cryptic statement that I highlighted before. He says, Abraham, in you, in other words, through one of your descendants, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And so there's this theme again. It's the promised son. Where's he going to come from? Who is he? He's going to be a descendant of Abraham, somebody who's a Jew, an Israelite. And we find out as the Bible unfolds, it's a Jew named Jesus, the Messiah, Jesus Christ, the Christ. That's the one that all of this is pointing to. And all of that is laid out in this passage. This passage, by the way, is probably the most important passage in the entire Bible. It's called the Abrahamic Covenant. This is the scarlet thread that's woven through the entire Bible. There's no other concept in the Bible that's more alluded to and referred back to and quoted than this passage. Because this passage is the great thing. It's telling us this is the great thing, the great plan that God is working in this world. And here's what's the most amazing thing about all that. It's that we can be involved in this. Humanity has a sin problem. God has a rescue plan. We've read it in Genesis 12, and you can be a part of it. And I realize that may be hard to accept. We're, 4,000 years after Abraham. We're 6,000 miles away from Haran. The notion that what we're reading here has anything to do with me, that seems preposterous. But it really isn't. It isn't because as the Bible unfolds, we see Christ is the one who offers his life. He's the one Abraham pointed to. And as we become Christians, as you begin a relationship with God, you're part of that. Look what it says in Galatians 3. Now that you belong to Christ, you're the true children of Abraham. You're his heirs. And God's promise to Abraham belongs to you. I became a Christian as a 9-year-old in the back seat of my neighbor's station wagon. They took me to church. And they had a teaching on what the Bible says about the end times. And it scared the crap out of me. I don't know if it's a kind of a weird way to deal with a little kid, but it worked. I became a Christian. And so in that car, softly I prayed to God, hey, I recognize what your son Jesus did for me. I know I need to be forgiven. And I called out to God, and the Bible teaches in that moment, God extended this blessing, this promise that a descendant of Abraham's will bless the world. This blessing touched my life. And the guy that I was with, there was a guy in the church that was talking to me in the station wagon. He laid out to me what it meant to be a Christian. That guy wasn't just talking to me. That's part of what was happening. I'm grateful he did it. But something bigger than that was happening. He was partnering with God in carrying out this great thing that God is doing in the world, extending the blessing of forgiveness through the promised Son, through Christ, to me. That's incredible. And that means any person here, all of us here, are potentially touched by what we're reading in Genesis 12 through this promise that God made to Abraham. So that's the great thing that God's doing. When you realize what this is, just the centuries that it spans, you're like, wow, that's way beyond what Abraham could ever do. This is way beyond what anyone could do. And that's why, for this to work, it requires faith. This is the other part of what we talked about. God can do great things through unlikely people, but it requires faith. And one of the best ways to understand what faith is just to look at how it's played out in Abraham's life. Now look at this last part of verse 1. He says, go forth from your country, from your relatives, from your father's house, to the land which I will show you. Okay, so as God lays this out, look at how specific he is about leaving. He's like, I want you to leave your house, your country, and your relatives. He's very crystal clear. I want you to leave those things. But when he turns around and points Abraham forward, he's super vague. This gives me flashbacks to being a little kid. Because I'd be like, where are we going? My parents would be like, well, you'll find out when we get there. Just hang in there. There's no real detail. It's just, hey, it's the land I'll show you. Let's go. That's it. And so that's what we see Abraham doing. We see him, amazingly, despite the lack of clarity about where this is all headed, in Genesis 12, verse 4, it says he departed. He uprooted his life. He loaded up the minivan, and he took off for a destination unknown. And that's crazy. I mean, think about what it would really take to literally leave everything and take off because you heard from God. That's what he did. And so one thing you can't deny that we're seeing here is Abraham was willing to act on the truth. I mean, imagine if you could go back in a time machine to 2100 BC. You're hanging out with Abraham on his back porch, drinking some beverages, just kind of chilling out. And he's like, hey, I got to tell you about this. God came to me and told me that he's got a land for me and he wants me to go. And you're like, well, that's cool. But then the months roll by. You're hanging out with, again, maybe 3 months later, you're still hanging out with Abraham. And you're sitting there and you're like, hey, I thought you heard from God that he's got this land for you. What about that? It just seems like you would leave Haran. What are you doing here? You know, and if the months kept rolling by, and visit after visit, he was sitting there on his back porch, at what point would you have to conclude, I'm not sure you really believe this. I'm not sure you're really willing to act. You say God spoke to you, but I just don't know if you believe it. At the end of the day, whatever faith is, it results in some kind of action. It isn't the action. It's not what we do, but it's an attitude that's willing to act. You think about how the author of Hebrews talks about this. He says, by faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. Now, he didn't obey by being obedient. He obeyed by faith. Obedience and faith are different. But one way we can tell he actually had faith is he went. Faith is willing to go. Faith is willing to act. That's one thing that's crystal clear from this passage. It's not passive. He didn't just keep rocking in his rocking chair. He didn't just keep watching the calendar days change. It's not mental assent. You know, it would be one thing to just acknowledge to God, I believe that land's there, and I think that is you talking to me, and I think you'll take care of me. But all that is mental assent. It's another thing to actually pack up your family and go. You know, imagine you go rappelling with somebody. It's kind of a breathtaking picture. I keep coming back to these rappelling and climbing themes here, but so you go rappelling with them, and you're talking and you're describing how the rope is actually able to hold a 2-ton car. It's a very strong rope. And the person you're with is, yeah, okay, yeah, it's cool. And they're kind of tugging it. And they're like, yeah, wow, I believe you. Right, that's one thing to say, I believe you. But really, how could we know? Until you are letting that rope suspend your full weight, we don't have any visible evidence of what the Bible calls faith. Because faith isn't just mental assent. Faith is willing to act. Now, on the flip side of this, the other thing you see in Abraham's travels as he goes on traveling is how he is depending on God to give him this land, to perform his will, to honor his promises. If you look on a map, after Abraham finally left Haran, he went on a lifelong road trip all over the promised land, freely moving about the promised land. I know a couple, some friends of our family, and this is what they do. They have a camper, and all they do all year is go from national park to national park to national park. And they work an odd job, make enough money, and then take off again. That's how they live. That's how these guys lived. They lived as nomads. You know, what's amazing is if you read this description, the account's really precise. It really tries to help us see what matters about this. It says the Lord comes to Abraham later. He comes to him, I don't know, sometime after he left Haran. And God says, lift up your eyes, Abraham. Look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward. So he's right in the middle of the promised land. He's like, look at it. And he says, for all the land which you see, I'll give it to you and to your descendants forever. So God leads Abraham right smack dab into the middle of everything he's going to give him and says, check it out. Now, what Abraham does here, and I should say what he does not do, is very instructive. He doesn't buy up land. One thing we know about Abraham is that he was fabulously wealthy. He's incredibly wealthy. He could have bought as much land as he wanted to. He also doesn't use military power. We skipped chapter 14. We just skipped it. I don't know if you noticed, but we went right over it. In chapter 14, Abraham leads 318 fighting men from his own household to go conquer 4 different kings. So Abraham had a small military. He was a power broker in this region, but he did not take any land in any battle. Instead, what we see him doing is just hanging out. Seriously. He loiters, he lingers, he meanders, he makes some friendships. He sees all those places I mentioned, but in the entire time he wanders, he never owns a stitch of land with one exception. When his wife died, he bought a small field and a cave so he could bury her. But aside from that, he was truly a nomad, roaming in the land God had given him. Why? Why is this? Why would such a powerful man be so passive about taking the land? Well, it's because the God who told him to go also is the God who said, I will give it to you. And when the New Testament looks back on this phase of Abraham's life, this is what it emphasizes. You see this willingness to act. He does go. And this is what faith is. It's a willingness to act on God's truth, depending on God's will to perform it. But, you know, when he goes, he's totally depending on God to deliver him the land. He doesn't seize it for himself. Look what this says. It says, by faith. But, you know, he was willing to go in dependence on God to give him the land. He lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. He was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. What is that saying? That's saying he wasn't going to seize the land himself. but he was going to trust what God would give him. That's such a perfect picture of faith. If you want to understand the biblical concept of faith, just think about that. That's whole story. Now, what I'd like to do before we move on to being an unlikely candidate is I'd like to think about a couple scenarios that relate to this issue of faith. Two scenarios we run into pretty frequently. One scenario is when people know and they might even agree with the Christian message, but they're not willing to act. Maybe you know people like this. You know, maybe they've done some Bible reading. Maybe you've done some Bible reading on your own. And you've got a really high view of Jesus. And you've got this sense that he was someone special. Or maybe you grew up in a church and you basically have no problem with what Christianity teaches. Maybe you're able to articulate the main message of Christianity, the gospel. The idea that Jesus was the promised son who offered his life to pay for our sin. Maybe you're comfortable with all that and you're familiar with it. You can talk about it. That's good. All those things are good. But according to this definition, that's not faith. Faith is something different. Faith is more than just mental assent. It's more than just agreeing with something. Faith is willing to act. Faith, and I'm not saying faith is a work we do. The Bible makes a clear contrast between faith and works. By grace we're saved through faith, and that not by works. But what I am saying is that faith is active. Faith is willing to take action. And the action that we need to be willing to take according to the Bible, to not just know about God, but to know God and have a relationship with him, is we got to reach out. This isn't really something you do. It's something you just, in your heart, you call out to God. Christ says, as many as received him, as received Jesus, to them he gave the right to become children of God, even those who believe in his name. So, as a churchgoer, as a Bible sympathizer, as somebody who's familiar with Christianity, can you remember this kind of willingness to act, where you actually called out to Christ and asked for his forgiveness? That's crucial, because that's a crucial part of faith. The other person that I think this has some bearing on, the other scenario, is when people have taken action, but they're not willing to depend on God. Okay, now this would be the person who went to church, who did the rituals, who made the charitable contributions, who were volunteering in the bake sale, who have lived ethical lives, who've done stuff, who have been active. Even to them, it's important to realize that's not faith. That's something. It's good, but it's not faith. Faith is a willingness to depend on God to do for us what we cannot do ourselves. That's what we see in the life of Abraham. You'll see it again in a bit. Look at the way, this is the beginning of that chapter in Hebrews I keep quoting. It talks about how men of old, like Noah and Abraham and Enoch, how did they get right with God? This is his answer. He says, faith is the assurance of things hoped for. You can see it's an attitude, the conviction of things not seen. He says, for by it, by what? By faith. Not by works, not by good deeds, not by consistent attendance, but by faith, the men of old gained approval. They depended on God to do what they could not do themselves. So this is crucial. If God's going to move in and do a great thing through an unlikely candidate, these attitudes, a willingness to act, but an awareness that God will have to make it happen, both have to be present. They've always had to be present to be right with God or to be used by God. Yeah, it makes sense. That's so crucial. Now, what have we been saying? We've been saying that God does great things through unlikely people who obey him in faith. Let's talk about unlikely people. Now, I mentioned already that Abraham came from a family of moon worshipers. That makes him pretty unlikely, but it's actually worse than I told you. There are other things that make him very unlikely. He was unlikely for sure. And God knew this. And God comes to him and reiterates his promise. God, if you read later, and we'll read it in a second, God tells him, no, I'm going to give you a land. I'm going to make you a nation. I'm going to give you a promised son. The only problem was Abraham's wife, Sarah, could not get pregnant. He's like, I'm going to make your descendants great. Well, I don't have any descendants. And so of all the people in the world that God picks, God, you know, to grow this great nation, he picks an ex-moon worshiper who can't have his wife get pregnant. Very unlikely candidate. And the thing is, if you read as the story of Abraham goes on, it's obvious he's painfully aware that he's not a good candidate, that he's an unlikely person for God to work through. Here's an exchange he had with God. God shows up. This is in Genesis 15. The word of the Lord came to Abraham in a vision, saying, don't fear, Abraham. I'm a shield to you. Your reward will be very great. Okay, so he lays this out. God comes back. He's like, seriously, I'm going to honor those promises I laid out. I'll protect you. And at this point, Abraham's like, well, I've got a question for you. He says, Lord, what are you going to give me since I'm childless? And the heir of my house is this Eliezer of Damascus. The only person I can turn my estate over and grow anything through is this servant in my house. You've got the wrong guy. There's nothing about my situation that's going to make this possible. That's him just painfully aware, I'm not the person that you're going to be able to work through. And actually, if you read in Romans, this went on. You know, Abraham and Sarah tried to have a kid for decades. And, you know, as this was going on, as they were aware this seemed so unlikely, Paul tells us the kind of things Abraham thought. Here it says Abraham contemplated his own body. At this point, he's like 85 years old. They didn't have a kid until he was 100 and Sarah was 99. Okay, so Abraham's contemplating his own body as good as dead and the deadness of Sarah's womb. How about that for a contemplation? Hey, honey, what are you thinking about? I'm thinking about how dead your womb is. That's pretty gross. So, you know, imagine you're walking around and you're just thinking about this and it just seems crazy. Like God's brought me into this nutty plan. Well, God knows that Abraham's beset with doubt. And remarkably, as the story goes on, we see Abraham actually, against all of the objections, he puts his faith in God. It says that God took Abraham outside. It's a clear, starry night. And he says, look toward the heavens and count the stars, if you're able to count them. And he said to him, so shall your descendants be. Now, this is a real pivotal moment. This is a pivotal moment, not just in Abraham's life, but in every person's life. When God calls on us, when God comes to us and says, I've got a great thing I'm doing, and I want you to be a part of it. And we're sitting there and we feel like, boy, I'm not the likely person to work through. I never thought I'd be a Christian. I never thought I'd do anything for God. That's a crucial moment. That the decision Abraham makes in this moment is titanic. Think of everything that will spill out from this. And amazingly, it says he believed in the Lord. Abraham believed in the Lord, and it says that God, at that point, when he sees that response of faith, that, just like we saw back in Hebrews, that was what made God reckon him as righteous. This is the moment that Abraham became right with God. And so, yeah, he was an unlikely candidate. He knew he was an unlikely candidate, and he put his faith in God, and wow, the outcome is still spilling out today. There's the outcome I just mentioned. Abraham became in a right relationship with God. That was one outcome of his faith. But as you go on, you also see him becoming part of the great thing that God is doing. You actually see God honor every single one of those things that Abraham could never do. He honors those promises. Think about God's imagery. And think about what it would have been like to be Abraham and walk out and just look up and see that someday I'm going to have this many descendants. And yet, despite the craziness of that picture, I mean, and you can read this. Abraham and Sarah were willing in faith to have sex decade after decade, about 25 years of being really old and really reluctant to do anything like this. Of people snickering as they shuffled off to the tent and lit candles and drank a bottle of wine or whatever they did. They did this. They were willing to do this. And they knew if she was going to get pregnant, it was going to be an absolute miracle. They knew. And yet we see these two themes. This is faith, a willingness, a dependent willingness all the way through. And this is the outcome that it says happens. In Hebrews it says, therefore, because of their faith, there was born even of one man, Abraham, and him as good as dead as that, as many descendants as the stars in heaven, and innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. And literally the ripple effects are still touching our lives today. And it all happened because an unlikely person obeyed God in faith. That's when great things happen. So what about this? What can we learn? You know, I studied the history of student ministry in the United States a while ago because I was interested. And I came across this woman named Evelyn McCluskey. And I'm just curious, has anyone ever heard of her before? Yeah, I thought so. She doesn't have a Wikipedia page. That's the best picture of her I could find. She, not well known, but probably has been used by God to reach more high school students than anybody in American history. Not thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of students. She got married as a young woman to a guy who was later diagnosed with epilepsy. She had to support the family by traveling around and offering training for a record company. So this is part of her job. He was frustrated with her travels, so he divorced her. And then at age 43, she had her own health problems, had to live with her parents, and while she was recuperating, somebody came to her and asked her to teach a high school Bible study for five girls, like it says there. And so she did. Within 4 months, 100 kids were coming, a co-ed meeting. It's crazy, but you can read all about this. Talbot Seminary has her biography. She called her Bible study the Miracle Book Club. And she would tell people she wanted to see it grow. And in a couple years, there were five of them. Her strategy was simple. It was the Bible for wild young people. That's how she does it. What am I trying to do? I'm trying to teach the Bible to crazy youth. That's what I do. And by the time she was 47, the Miracle Book Club had grown to an international movement with 267 chapters. You may have heard of some well-known leaders who got their start in this movement. These are people whose first ministry experience was leading a Miracle Book Club. One was Francis and Edith Schaeffer. Actually, when they went to Europe, this is one of the things they wanted to do. Another was Jim Rayburn. Jim Rayburn founded Young Life. He adapted the Miracle Book Club model and used it in Young Life. And another person that was very involved in MBC was Al Metzger, who went on and again adapted that model and started Youth for Christ. If you know anything about Young Life and Youth for Christ, holy crap, this woman spawned something that maybe reached millions of students over and still is. And wow, a 47-year-old divorcee in a day when that was a That was quite a stigma. She was not a likely candidate. I mean, undeniably. And I'll tell you, history is filled with people with stories like this. Unlikely candidates who took a step in faith, who were powerfully used to touch a lot of people's lives. And I was thinking about, just us here. I'm not saying everybody in this room has got to, figure out a way to reach millions of people or something like that. But what is it that keeps people from taking a step in faith? A lot of times is we feel like we're unlikely, and we feel like we're unlikely because we did that once. We agreed to lead something. We agreed to respond to the nudge and try to talk to a neighbor, or we did something else. And maybe it went smoothly for a while. Maybe it was growing and thriving for a while, but then we hit a pothole. It might be moral failure. It might be maybe a period of illness that knocked us out. Or we made some bad judgment calls that upset people. Or we tried to do it in our own strength and it just didn't work out. You know, I'm 4 for 4 on those. I don't know about you, but a lot of us, we have stepped out in faith despite feeling unlikely. And for whatever reason, we hit a pothole. And I just hope, we don't have time to go through all of it, but I hope you're encouraged by Abraham's story. Abraham's road to being used to do great things was not smooth. He had moral lapses before and after he was converted in Genesis 15. He 2 different times tried to pawn his wife off as a sister to protect himself. That's not a harbinger of greatness right there. It's pretty bad. Not only that, but we also see with him there were doubts that crept in. At one point, he and Sarah were so despondent about ever having their own child. Abraham had a child through one of his servant women. And that was a disaster for the family. That was a total train wreck. And so this guy, Abraham, had speed bumps, had potholes, had disruptions to being used by God, and yet God still powerfully worked through him. And so I think it's important to realize maybe the step of faith God's asking you to do is just to dust yourself off and believe again that God does great things to unlikely people who obey him in faith. The other thing I would, ask yourself, is God limited by what's happened in your past? No, he is not. He's not limited. And then one last thing here. There are people, and I know there are people here because I've talked to them, that are taking steps, big steps of faith. We have a group of people that are about to lead a new home church. Some of them for the first time leading a group. We've got folks that are about to have a very difficult conversation with somebody that they're in conflict with, but they're fighting for reconciliation. We have people that are going into a new phase of life where they're ill and they don't have the bandwidth and capacity that they used to, and yet they still are trying to present themselves to be used by God in however way they can be. There are people in this room all over the place that are taking huge steps of faith. And when we do, and if that's you, I would just urge you to do so with a sense of anticipation. With this awareness, something, and I can't see it yet, and it may take decades or centuries to see the ripple effect, but if an unlikely person like me takes a step, then God will use it in powerful ways. I think that's a big part of what Abraham's whole life is all about. So,
yeah, Father, we got a day in front of us, a week, a year. We got the rest of our lives ahead of us. And you are going to come to us, and you're going to appeal to us to join you in what you're doing. And I know there's going to be times when we just don't feel like a likely candidate, that we feel disqualified, discouraged, uncertain, that chapter of our life is still open where we could be used by you. And I just pray you'd give us the strength to affirm in the positive that, yes, we want to obey you in faith, Lord. Help us do that with a sense of anticipation. And I thank you that we're sitting here in this room with evidence all around us that when people do that, you do great things. So help us keep believing this, God. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.